Welcome to Get Over It, the Intuitive Transformation Podcast for Exceptional 21st Century Living. We've got a different show today. We're going to be talking about antidepressants and depression and mindfulness and how can you work through all of that. We're going to be talking about how you can change your relationship with depression. Very powerful show based on the book When Antidepressants Aren't Enough by Dr. Stuart Eisendrath. So we'll get into this, and we're going to have a lot of meaningful, deep information for you. So, you know, take some notes, and then, of course, go out and get the book, because it will help you, especially if you know anyone who's dealing with depression. Now, the information shared on Get Over It uses intuitive and pragmatic insight to help you break through blocks and release energy that is no longer needed. Yes, we're going to help you release your BS that is holding you back. But you guys know I always ask the question, are you truly ready to? And by the way, folks, BS is belief system. Now, a bit about me for my new listeners, intuitive since birth. I'm a third-generation intuitive with over 3 decades of experience helping people break through the blocks along their path. I'm a strategist for personal and professional transformation, revealing information which enables you to become a master builder of your life. I spent 25 successful years in corporate America as an executive sales professional, and I am the founder of Healing Visions Ministries and the Northern California Children's Education Network, a 501c3 nonprofit. I authored Getting Your M&Ms, The Men and Money Book, and Masterful Choices, The Key to Easy, Effective Change. I provide consultations and healings regarding relationships, business, career, money, and love that heal the mind-body-spirit connection, allowing you to live your life to the absolute fullest. Now, my clients tell me that I keep it real while providing them with accurate information to assist them along their journey as a spirit living a human existence. But they also say, if you really don't want to know, don't ask Monique. My background includes a doctorate in metaphysics, Reiki master teacher, ordained minister, and clinical hypnotherapist. So whether you are stressed, depressed, or possessed, I can help. To find out more about me and the services I offer, go to my website, and that's MoniqueChapman.com, and I invite you to like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn. Excuse me. In addition to offering an in-depth exploration into what mindfulness means when antidepressants aren't enough, includes easily practiced breath exercises, meditation, and innovative visualizations that are designed to help release readers from what can often feel like the tyranny of their thoughts. The book's techniques, combined with medicine or on their own, can serve as a personal mindfulness practice. Dr. Stuart Eisendrath is the author of When Antidepressants Aren't Enough and the founding director of the University of California San Francisco Depression Center, a senior clinician and research psychiatrist at UCSF. His lectures on mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for University of California TV have been viewed more than 1.5 million times, and you can check him out at his website, and that is stuarteisendrath.com, stuarteisendrath.com. Welcome, Dr. Eisendrath.
Thank you.
Hey, it's so great to have you here. You know, you've written a very timely book about antidepressants and depression and mindfulness. They all seem to be buzzwords at this point in time. What brought you to the point of writing the book? You've been practicing in this arena for over 20 years, so why the book now?
Well, the book is aimed at people who have tried antidepressants and haven't gotten a full recovery. And unfortunately, this is an all too common occurrence. In the largest study of antidepressants, the STAR-D study, people were given an antidepressant, and at the end of 12 weeks, about 30% had recovered. And then they were, for the other group who hadn't recovered, they were given a second antidepressant trial, mm-hmm. and that added an additional 20%. So at the end of 2 antidepressant trials, which is often more than people actually get, there was 50% of people who had recovered, but that means 50% hadn't recovered. So I wanted to help give a technique that would help those people the 50% who hadn't recovered, to be able to learn a technique that would empower them and give them the skill set that they could actually improve their own life.
Okay. Well, with more than over 100 million people suffering from depression, what can people do to truly recover from it? Because it seems like, you know, if you take an antidepressant, it doesn't work, and you might be willing to try two or three, you know, if the doctor's willing to prescribe them. And then when it doesn't work, you just give up.
Well, there are techniques now available. We've made a lot of progress. For example, transcranial magnetic stimulation is one approach. ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, is another approach. And mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is one that differs from the first two because it teaches people skills that they can take with them wherever they go. So there's a number of techniques that can be added to somebody who has failed to recover despite two or more antidepressant trials.
Okay. Well, in your book, When Antidepressants Aren't Enough, you talk about mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And your program is basically an 8-week program where people can learn the techniques and adjust their view of depression and anxiety and then therefore heal. Tell us more.
Well, that's right. People can actually learn techniques that will help them recover. And it's aimed at teaching people techniques through simple meditations. They actually are, they're available for free on my website.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be downloaded or streamed. And these techniques, along with the book, help people learn how to approach depression in a different way. So instead of being stuck in a depressive state, they can actually do something that will help them get out of it. Our research shows that this can be very effective. We had an NIH-sponsored study that looked at people over an 8-week period and then outwards for a 1-year follow-up, and found that this was a very effective approach.
Well, the mindfulness component seems to be the key here because cognitive therapy has been out there, you know, forever. So how does the mindfulness component of this truly help someone, first of all, release the shame of being depressed and then get into the mode of healing and making their life better?
Well, that's a very good question. It actually helps people. First of all, as you say, that many people who have depression are ashamed of it, feel that it's a moral weakness, and we teach people that actually it's neither. That just like somebody who has diabetes or asthma, that they wouldn't say, boy, I'm a terrible person because I have another episode of those illnesses.
Uh-huh.
It's just my illness. It's a recurrent illness, and there's something I can do about it. And the same thing is true with depression. If they're suffering from depression, they can learn that it's not a moral weakness. It's just an illness that is recurring, and they can do something about it to make a change.
Okay. Well, how do we get past the stigma of, you know, mental health? Because, I mean, if you break your arm, you go to the doctor and you're bragging, you know, I got a cast on and I broke my arm and Dr. So-and-so fixed it. But when your mind breaks, you just want to keep it quiet because, you know, of the judgment that's at least perceived from others.
Well, one way is to enhance your self-compassion. And when we measured self-compassion, people actually had increases in self-compassion with this approach.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have increased self-compassion, it's like putting a lens on in front of yourself. So, for example, if you make a mistake, if you're depressed, you may be very critical of yourself. Self-criticism is a hallmark of depression. Whereas if you apply the lens of self-compassion, when you make a mistake, you may say to yourself, oh, okay, I made a mistake. That's what humans do. I can learn from that mistake, and I can move on with my life without being critical of myself. I can realize that making mistakes is part of the common human experience, and not be critical of yourself and lessen that stigma.
Okay. Now, your book, when antidepressants aren't enough, it really uses the power of mindfulness. So tell the audience, what is mindfulness in your opinion, and how can that combined with cognitive therapy truly bring about healing?
Well, mindfulness is being aware of your experience as you are experiencing it and suspending judgment about it. This includes things like sensations, thoughts, and feelings. And mindfulness can really be thought of as shining a spotlight of attention on an area that you select. You may focus on your thoughts, you may focus on your breath, your body sensation, whatever you decide to focus on. And as you do so, you become focused in the present moment. And being focused in the present moment is a natural antidepressant and anti-anxiety treatment. Because I look at depression and anxiety as essentially being on a similar spectrum of time. In a sense, the depression and anxiety are disorders of time. For example, if you're focused on depression, that is an experience where you feel as if a loss has already occurred in your life. It may be a loss of a loved one or a job or some other situation where you've experienced a loss. But in depression, you keep ruminating about that loss in the past, whereas anxiety is concerned with thinking that a loss is going to take place in the future, and what we say is catastrophizing about that loss.
Mm-hmm.
So what mindfulness does is teach you to be focused on the present moment and let go of thoughts about the past or the future and just be present focused. And by doing so, you take up the bandwidth of your mind, so there really is little bandwidth available to focus on the past or the future. You're just in the present moment, focusing on the breath or the body sensations or what your experience is like just in this moment.
Okay. You know, in your book, you talk about your thoughts are not necessarily your friends. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
Well, that's right. In depression, your thoughts are not your friends because they tend to be negative. If you're in a depressed state, you tend to generate quite a bit of negative thoughts. And those negative thoughts, in turn, go to cycle back and create more depression.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you have the thought, I won't succeed, I'm a failure, I'll never be successful, I'm a bad person, and that gets at the stigma. I'm just somebody who'll always be a failure. Those are thoughts that if you believe those thoughts, it'd be natural to get depressed or even more depressed. But those thoughts are just that. They're thoughts and not facts. And that's what's important to learn about in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. I'm having the thought I'm a failure, and that's just a thought. Somebody else may see me as being successful. So when you have a thought like that, it's very common in depression, and it's just a thought and not a fact.
Okay. Well, folks, we're speaking with Dr. Stuart Eisenrath. His book is When Antidepressants Aren't Enough, Harnessing the Power of Mindfulness to Alleviate Depression, and you can check him out at his website. And that is StuartEisendrath.com, StuartEisendrath.com. On his website, you'll find a lot of useful information. But, you know, folks, I rarely do this, but I really want you to go out and get this book. I really push a book like this, but I really want you to go out and get this book, because just reading it, I thought of several people who needed it, and I bought copies off of Amazon to give to them so that they can help themselves if they choose. But if you're suffering from this or know someone in your life who's suffering from this, the information on mindfulness and anxiety and the steps to overcome it, I have found to be very effective. The book is an easy read. It's not medical jargon or scientific-y. It's easy to read and very easy to implement. Dr. Eisendrath, you talk about early on in the book some basic mindfulness, and you talk about the body scan. And I really feel that, you know, you put that right at the right spot, because it seems to be an easy introduction, if you will. Could you tell the audience more about the body scan?
Well, the body scan is basically applying mindfulness to body sensations and the experiences in your body. So, for example, if you're focusing on your left foot, you notice the sensations that are present in the toes and the feet and the foot, and then move up from there to the left lower leg, and basically move along throughout all parts of your body. And you're experiencing these things, you're focusing the attention just on what is experienced at that moment. Mm-hmm. And so it is a very good way. All of us have bodies, and it's a way to focus on your attention and be gentle with yourself. Because what will happen as you go through the parts of your body, your mind will be distracted. Your mind will wander. But the art of meditation in this approach is saying, oh, my mind wandered. I noticed it. I congratulate myself for noticing it. And then bring the attention back to the body part you're focusing on. Many people have the misconception that meditating means I lock my mind on one thing, and then it never wanders, or I'll empty my mind of all thoughts. Those are erroneous beliefs, because even in the most experienced meditator, the mind wanders. That's what minds do. Mm-hmm. Our minds are trained, in essence, to keep wandering. And so what you learn in this technique is, oh, my mind wandered. I just gently bring it back without criticizing myself, with applying self-compassion to the fact my mind wandered, and say, okay, here it is, I'll bring it back. It's kind of like having a puppy on a leash. You know, the puppies tend to wander around playfully, mm-hmm. and if you tug them very hard, it's not going to help things. But if you gently pull on the leash, they'll come back. So that's really what we do with mindfulness. Our minds wander, and we bring it back to the body sensations that we're experiencing.
Okay. So in your book, you know, speaking of meditation, could you say the M word? And so many people are like, oh, no, staying away from that because I just can't do it. You also talk about a walking meditation. Tell us about that.
Well, walking meditation is another approach. There's basically two kinds of meditation. One is a discrete form of meditation in which you, say, sit down in a chair or on the floor, and you focus on things like the body sensations or the breath, for example. Mm-hmm. But there's another form of meditation called dispositional mindfulness, in which you focus on things as you're experiencing them, such as walking. So as you're walking, you pay attention to what are the sensations in my feet and my lower legs as I walk. And it's a really quite remarkable thing, because if you start focusing on those sensations, a lot is really going on there. You know, your heel strikes the pavement first, and then your foot kind of rolls while the other foot is in the air, and then you push off with the ball and toes of your foot, and the other leg comes down and the heel strikes again. So there's a lot of sensations, if you focus on it, that you can become aware of. And then again, same thing. If your mind wanders as you're doing it, You gently bring it back to focusing on the sensations in the feet. So you can apply this dispositional mindfulness to virtually anything. You can be in the kitchen chopping vegetables and focus your attention on chopping of the vegetables. What does it feel like to do it? What are your sensations as you do it? And if your mind wanders, you bring the attention back to the thing you're focusing on.
Okay. So how has your relationship with depression helped you in bringing this work out to the world?
Well, in my case, I experienced depression related to some stresses in my life. And when I did that, I developed quite a few guilty thoughts. And guilty thoughts are common in depression, self-critical and guilty thoughts. And for a long time, when I first experienced it, I tried to figure out what was I guilty about, and what had I done something in the past that warranted being guilty? Had I committed some type of crime, either in fact or in a wish, that I was guilty about? And I spent a lot of time trying to do this. Mm-hmm. And then slowly I realized those guilty thoughts were just symptoms of depression. They weren't facts that I had to unearth. They were symptoms of depression. And people often don't recognize that there are symptoms of depression that are reflected in our thoughts and feelings. In other words, people recognize that disorders of sleep or disorders of appetite or disorders of weight are common in depression. But just as common are thoughts that occur in depression. In fact, the top 30 thoughts in depression have already been cataloged, and each person tends to have a unique signature of what their depressive thoughts are, kind of like Letterman's top 10. Mm-hmm. For you, these are your depressive thoughts. And in my case, they were guilty thoughts. And when I finally realized that those guilty thoughts were just that, thoughts and symptoms of depression, I began to change my relationship to those thoughts and stop trying to dig up and unearth what were the origins of it. But in other words, recognize they were just thoughts and I didn't have to focus on them as being facts.
Okay. Well, so many of us, I think, believe that our thoughts are facts, and we're not distinguishing between the two. So when you find yourself going down that rabbit hole of the depressive thoughts, how do you bring yourself up immediately to say, no, this is false, this is not real, and then shift over into a mindfulness state of being?
Well, one way is to challenge yourself a bit to say, is this thought an actual fact, or is it just a thought? For example, if you see a table, that's a fact. Uh-huh. If you see the table and you say, this table's an ugly table, or this table's a beautiful table, well, those labels are just thoughts. You and I may look at the same table and have quite different opinions of it.
Right.
And the fact there is there's a table. And when you start to challenge yourself about, is this thought a fact or not, it becomes a little simpler to realize most of what we come up with when we're depressed are thoughts, and usually negative thoughts. There's the old radio show, or not, it wasn't radio, it was radio and TV, called Dragnet, mm-hmm. in which Sergeant Friday would question witnesses, and he would say, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts.
I remember that so well. I think I'm showing my age, but I remember that very well. So do you feel that everybody goes through a depressive period in their lifetime?
Many people do. It's the most common illness, really, and it's the number one cause of disability in the world. Uh-huh. So if you think about that, I mean, it's a more common cause of disability than heart disease or cancer or any of the other major illnesses. So it is a real problem. Not everybody experiences it, but many people do. And at any one point, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning, over 100 million people are suffering from it, according to the World Health Organization. So it's a pretty pervasive thing, and it's more common that you'll know somebody who has depression than you'll know somebody who has a broken limb.
Yeah, especially since depression, you can't see it on the physical, the broken limb, you can. Now, in your opinion, does depression actually fully heal? I mean, can someone be depressed for a period of time, say years, and then get over it and not experience it again?
Well, that's a good question. People could definitely get over it and go into what we call complete remission.
Uh-huh.
But depression, it tends to be a recurrent illness. So
uh-huh.
if you have one episode of depression, there's a 90% chance that within 10 years you'll have another episode. And if you have two episodes,
uh-huh.
there's a 90% chance that you'll have another episode within 3 years. So
wow.
really, you need a technique that can help prevent relapses.
Uh-huh.
And that's how mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was first developed, as a relapse prevention strategy. So in a study that was done looking at people who had a depressive episode and had completely recovered, they either went along with usual treatment or they received mindfulness-based cognitive therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was found that it offered twice as good a chance as staying free of another relapse. In an even more powerful study, it took people who had fully recovered with antidepressants and divided them into two groups. In one group, they continued to receive the antidepressants on a maintenance basis. In the other group, they received mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and were tapered off of the antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of a 2-year follow-up period, they were equivalent in preventing relapse. So the people who had been tapered off and received mindfulness training and the people who continued on antidepressants. So mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was just as good as continuing medications in preventing relapse. And this is important because many people don't want to be on maintenance medications for the rest
mm-hmm.
of their life.
Uh-huh.
They'd like to get into a program where they can be free of the side effects and cost and problems associated with antidepressants. And this technique teaches them skill sets that they can take with them and help prevent relapse, just as if they had continued the antidepressants.
Very interesting, because I know not too long ago I was experiencing some pain and I went to the doctor, you know, the usual Tylenol and whatever, wasn't taking it away. And he prescribed an antidepressant, and I said, but I don't think I'm depressed at this current time. And he said, well, it'll get rid of the pain. So is it, and it did. So is it common that physicians will prescribe an antidepressant for symptoms that are not necessarily depressive, at least on the surface?
Yes, it can be quite common. Some of the antidepressants are better than others and can have anti-pain effects. For
mm-hmm.
example, people with diabetic neuropathy, a low dose of a certain antidepressant, a tricyclic antidepressant, is very effective. Usually in those instances, the dose of an antidepressant is lower than it is for a person who's depressed, but some of the antidepressants can be quite helpful in dealing with chronic pain.
Okay. So, but still, going back to mindfulness would alleviate the necessity of possibly of taking the medication for pain or anything else?
Yes, it can definitely help, because the same thing applies to emotional pain as physical pain.
Mm-hmm.
One way of looking at it is pain times resistance equals suffering. And whether the pain is physical or the pain is depression, how we look at that is really determines how much suffering we have.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you think of physical pain, if you say to yourself, oh, what did I do to deserve this? Or, oh, this is terrible. Or, oh, I'll never get over this. It's really those forms of resistance to the pain that amplify your suffering. If you take an animal, if you take a bear in the woods who steps on a thorn and gets a thorn in its paw, it doesn't say, why did I get this? Did I do something wrong with my mother that I got this thorn in my foot? They merely try to pull it out and take an action that relieves the pain. And they don't get into all of the forms of resistance that humans do.
Mm-hmm.
Humans do what we call adventitious suffering. They add a component to the pain. And in depression, it's thoughts like, I'm a bad person for having pain, I'm a weak person, or I'll never get better, and so on. And if you add those to it, you're going to feel worse. So if you say, I'm never going to get better, well, naturally you're going to feel worse, because that's if you accept that thought as being true, accept it as a fact, you're going to feel worse. But if you can say, I'm having the thought that I'll never get better, then
mm-hmm.
you can say, I can let go of that thought and bring my attention back to the object of my attention in my meditation.
Okay. Talk to us a bit about anxiety disorders and depression, because they seem to almost go hand in hand.
Well, they do. It's a very good point. In our study of the people who had persistent depression after two or more antidepressant trials, we found that approximately 75% of those people also had anxiety disorders. So they do go hand in hand. And as I said before, they're really along the time continuum, where people who have depression are locked on the past, and people who are anxious are locked on the future. So
mm-hmm.
people who have anxiety symptoms, and they can range across the spectrum from panic disorders to simple phobias to social anxiety disorders. They can range really across a wide variety. And I'll give you an example. One woman came into a mindfulness group that we had, and she came in with anxiety. She was anxious about her children. She had three children. And she said every time they go out, she feels anxious. She worries. If her son is out on a Saturday night, she worries he's going to get into an accident on the way home.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's going to be some kind of disaster that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
She learned, and then she would be critical of herself for having that kind of thought. Like, I shouldn't be having this thought. I should be feeling okay. And it's important when you say, I should, to replace it with the phrase, it would be nice if I didn't have that thought. Sometimes I say to my son, you should be doing this or that, and he answers back, you mean, Dad, it would be nice if I did that. It was kind of a little way of reframing things, and
mm-hmm.
it's important to try to replace that should. But anyhow, the woman who had that anxiety about her children learned that her thoughts about the children were just that. They were thoughts. They weren't facts. Her children came home, and they were healthy and hadn't gotten into accidents. But this is important. She still kept having those thoughts. But
mm-hmm.
the thoughts as she recognized they were not facts, faded into the background. So they were still there, but it was like a radio being turned down. They were still there, but the volume wasn't high enough that it continued to bother her, and she wasn't critical of herself for having those thoughts. So she improved dramatically, not in the way she thought she was going to come in, by turning off the thoughts completely, but instead by relinquishing the criticism she had about herself and letting the thoughts fade into the background.
Well, it's truly life-changing, because if you can reach that point, it seems like nothing would affect you negatively. At least you're not allowing things to affect you negatively.
That's right. It's, as a famous philosopher said, it's not the things themselves that bother us. It's our attitudes about those things. And that was Epictetus, an ancient Roman philosopher, who said that, and it's so true. It isn't often the thing itself that it bothers us, but what we're thinking about that thing, what our resistance is to that thing.
Okay. Now, what about a person, like, say, a young adult or even adolescents who are being bullied, and that causes a certain level of depression? Is there a mindfulness technique that, you know, someone maybe, you know, a little bit younger than a full-grown adult could utilize to help them release that harsh energy that's coming to them that makes them so anxious because, you know, they're being pounded on, you know, every day?
Well, bullying is a complex thing. I think, you know, if it's taking place, everything needs to be done. I mean, that's the pain. And just like if the bear taking the thorn out, if you can stop the bullying or remove the person who's being bullied from that situation, that can be very important. But mindfulness can help the person who's being bullied if they're able to say to themselves, I'm being bullied not because I'm a bad person, but because there are bullies in the world, and change the thoughts the bullied person may have about themselves so they can still feel good about themselves. Again, bring self-compassion to the picture and not feel that they're a bad person.
Okay. So it's about truly taking a look at their BS, their belief system, about who they are, and not allowing that outside influence to, like, take root. Does that make sense?
Exactly. Yes, exactly right.
Okay. So talk to us a bit before we go about anger and depression, because a lot of depressed people sometimes tend to be quite a bit angry.
Yes, that's true. Sometimes I like to think of depression, or when I'm talking with somebody who's depressed, either thinking with them or trying to understand it, by asking the question, who are you depressed at? In other words, who might you be angry with that instead of expressing the anger directly, you're becoming depressed? And depression is often associated with being angry but not expressing it very well, sort of submitting to somebody else. And I'll give you an example of this. A woman came in and she was very depressed, and as it turned out, she was very angry with her partner because her partner wasn't agreeing with her idea of starting to have a family and have children. And she was very angry at him for this situation. And as she became more mindful, she was able to, in essence, cook the anger And instead of just being angry, she was able to listen to him and mm-hmm. realize he was holding off on having children, not because of anything related to her, but rather because he was frightened of the prospect and didn't think he would be a very good father. And when she was able to understand that, she was able to open up a conversation with him about it mm-hmm. and address it directly rather than just being angry and depressed about it. So it changed her approach to her relationship quite dramatically. So anger is a very common driver of depression and also often a consequence of depression. So if you can have an opportunity to change what's going on with anger by looking at it differently, it can greatly diminish depression.
Okay, and folks, if you greatly diminish the depression, guess what? Your life gets a whole lot better because you don't have that negative influence around you. Dr. Eisendrath, when we go to your website, stuarteisendrath.com, that's stuarteisendrath, what are we going to find there?
Well, you'll find really more information about the book and what the different sections of the book are, how they deal with things. You'll find a link to the audio files from the book that you can either stream or download and use those meditations to start practicing your meditation. And you'll find some other information about, there's a video of me that gives sort of a concise overview of the process. Mm-hmm. And also you'll find some of the people who recommended the book as being useful. So there's some endorsements that help clarify why the book can be so helpful.
Okay. So, lastly, before we go ahead.
And there's also a blog there that helps explain some of the issues that occur with depression as well.
Okay, great. Before we go, what is your highest hope that readers will take away from your book?
My highest hope is that people will realize depression is a challenging thing to treat, but there are ways of learning how to cope with it and treat themselves with more compassion mm-hmm. so that instead of being critical of themselves, they can realize it's a widespread illness and in some ways it's part of the common human experience. And there are techniques that can help them deal with it, prevent relapse, help them achieve full recovery, and that the techniques really are empowering. So I hope people will understand that and take that away from the book.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate your time and attention. Folks, we've been speaking with Dr. Stuart Eisendrath. The book is When Antidepressants Aren't Enough, Harnessing the Power of Mindfulness to Alleviate Depression. Folks, this is a book that you should have on your shelf. Number one, you should read and pass around to others because at some point in time, just about everybody experiences some level of depression. And even if you're not depressed, the mindfulness techniques, which there are many in the book, one of my favorite ones is the RAIN technique on page 116, and you got to go get the book so you'll know what I'm talking about. It's useful in everyday life for everybody. So if you're truly interested in working on yourself, healing yourself, helping to heal society, go get this book. So Dr. Eisendrath, thank you. And to the audience, thank you for being with me today as we collectively get over it. The divine in me honors the divine in you. I'm honored and I truly appreciate everybody's time and attention. When you're ready to raise your vibration and shift your energy, you can give me a call. Intuitive consultations, 30 minutes or longer, are offered at a 10% discount if you mention the podcast. Love yourself enough to make an investment in yourself. Make that call. 888-240-6057. And remember, the most important choice that you can make is what you choose to make important. Consider making the magical choice of harnessing the power of mindfulness to alleviate depression. Abundant blessings, light and love to all. Namaste.